Hello and welcome to the Cherry Hills Church Podcast. We're in a teaching series called The Questions of Jesus as we journey through Lent together. We're considering how the questions of Jesus reveal what we truly believe. Thanks so much for listening.
A reading from John chapter 21. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said. "You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Take a seat, friends. Good morning. My name's Luke. I'm the spiritual formation minister here at Cherry Hills Church. It's so great to be with you. We are officially passed through the season of Lent, which is a season of fasting, and we have entered into, as of last week, the season of Eastertide, a season of feasting. So we're going to wrap up this week a series that we've been in all throughout the season of Lent called The Questions of Jesus. Questions of Jesus. And in this series, we've been exploring a handful of the many, many questions that Jesus asks throughout the Gospels. Questions that are provocative, powerful questions intended to confront and reveal things within the hearers and within us who are confronted by these same questions today. So I'm going to be teaching from most of John chapter 1, a few other places in John's gospel this morning. If you don't have a Bible, there's one under the seats around you. We'd love for you to grab one of those and follow along with us. If you don't have a copy of God's Word at home, it's yours to keep. We'd love for you to take that home with you so you've got one. In the scene from John 21 that Daniel just read for us, Jesus asks roughly the same question three times. It's unique. Roughly the same question three times. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And this whole scene leads us today into a related question. If you're following along in your message notes, the question is this: how does Jesus and how do we respond when we fail to live up to the love that we profess? How does Jesus respond and how do we respond when we fail to live up to the love that we profess? I just had the privilege of officiating a wedding this past Friday, and it was sweet, beautiful, holy time. The bride and groom, you know, we get to the vows, and they do the traditional vows, you know, the ones, you know, in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, right? You know those vows. And I love the traditional lines. I've noticed, though, a lot of couples today will do more creative vows, I'll say it that way. And I hope I'm not stepping on any toes here, right? But you know, these kind of vows that you write that are meaningful for you as a couple. Things like, "I vow to make you breakfast in bed every Saturday." Oh, that's sweet, isn't it? "I vow to never make you cry and always make you laugh." Or, "I vow to write you a poem every week for as long as we both shall live." It's very cute. It's very unattainable. But here's the thing, right? The traditional vows are pretty unattainable, too. It's hard. We never muster up enough resolve to fully walk in and live up to the vows that we are professing. By your first anniversary, if you're doing the poem thing, you're going to hate poetry, right? You're going to hate it. So we're never going to be able to fully live up to the vows. It's the nature of the human condition and any kind of relationship that we're in, that we are going to mess it up and not live up to the love we profess. Simon Peter can relate. At the end of John chapter 13, Jesus has just had this special final meal with his disciples in the upper room. And he's gone down on his knees and taken out a water basin, and he's washed his disciples' feet as a show of service and humility and love. And then Jesus says, "Where I'm going, you cannot come. Where I'm going, you cannot come." And in John chapter 13, it says this, verse 36, Simon Peter asked him, "Lord, where are you going?" And Jesus replied, "Where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." And Peter asked, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Here's another question Jesus asks. Will you really lay down your life for me? Will you really? Before sunup the next day, Simon Peter had denied any association with Jesus whatsoever. Three times by a charcoal fire in the courtyard of the high priest, Peter says, "I don't know the man. I don't know the man. I don't know the man." And someone says to Peter, "But you have a Galilean accent. Surely you're one of his followers." And Peter says, No. I'm telling you, I was never with the Nazarene." And somebody says, "But no, I saw you. You were in the garden when they arrested him. Surely you were with him." And he's like, "Curse you. I'm telling you, I don't know that guy." Three times, "I don't know the man." And the day dawns. The rooster crows, and Peter weeps, filled with sorrow and remorse, remembering the words of Jesus that he would deny. So why is it? Why is it that Peter fails to live up to the love that he professes? Why does he get it wrong in this moment? In fact, we might expect him, if anybody we could expect, to get it right. I mean, Peter is so often the bold one, the one to speak his mind and say the right thing. Steve taught us last week, Peter's the one who professes, "You are the Messiah, you are the Christ." He's the one who in a sense seems to get it. In the garden, Peter drew a sword and the sword drew blood. He's chopping off ears and going after people trying to fight for Jesus. He's ready to kill for his Lord. True believer, fanatical. So why is it that Peter shrinks back in this moment? The rock, you know? Why does he shrink back from this moment? Peter fails probably for the same reasons that I do and that you do. Love is easier said than done. Some people will kill for love, it seems. Fewer will die for it and suffer for it. Love in the high moments, it's grand, it's sublime, it's the mountaintops, it's awesome. And love in the day-to-day is hard. It's tough. It brings things out of us that calls us to places we don't want to go, forces on us things we don't want to do, you know? Simple stuff. I don't want to do the dishes sometimes. I don't want to change diapers. I don't want to do the laundry. I don't want to mow the lawn. You know, I don't want to serve and help, and I don't want to pick up from daycare. Like, I don't want to do all these things sometimes. Sometimes I don't want to answer a friend's phone call. I want to just keep watching the show that I'm watching on TV, you know? I don't want to get to know a neighbor. I don't want to give more money away. I don't want to reconcile with a jerk, and I don't want to admit when I'm wrong, you know? We don't want to do things that love demands from us. And despite all the big talk, Peter, like me, like you, goes through life trying to minimize and bypass suffering as much as possible. How can I get around the hard way of life that love demands? Now, all the things I just named, listed off as examples, those are all, let's admit, first world problems. And what Simon Peter is dealing with is literal, actual, physical suffering and death. So let's not be harder on Simon Peter than we are on ourselves, yeah? Peter's actually facing something that would be hard for me and for most of us to even imagine. Peter faced a situation when who he thought that Jesus was, what his mission was about, what it was going to accomplish, and what it would demand of him, All of that changes in a moment in the Garden of Gethsemane when torches and swords appear and Judas betrays with a kiss. Everything is different after that. His Lord is bound and led away, stretching out his hands unto death. If you're following in your notes, Peter's rock-solid confession turned out to be hollow. This is part of the nature of following Jesus, friends. You stick around Jesus long enough, and he starts to disabuse you of prior illusions you might have had about what following him would mean. Our illusions of exceptional belief and unwavering faith and personal control over the trajectory of our lives, all of that, it's mere illusion. And following Jesus will pull that out and reveal it for what it is. Jason Isbell, artist, has a lyric. I love this. He says this: "You thought God was an architect. Now you know. He's something like a pipe bomb ready to blow. And everything you've built, it's all for show, goes up in flames in 24 frames." Following Jesus closely is dangerous. It's a hazard to our ego and to our comfort. Jesus dismantles the lies that we believe and the assumptions that we hold and the prejudices that we harbor, the certainty that we cling to, the comfort that we linger in, the sins we languish in, and the fear and the pride that captures us. All of that blown apart in following Jesus closely. Jesus has a phrase for this in John 15, pruning the vine. Pruning the vine. It's hard, but it's necessary, and it's good, and it brings forth further fruit. And it's on the other side of this disorienting and devastating failure that after Jesus is raised from the dead, he goes to Simon Peter in the scene that we heard this morning. He finds the disciples fishing on the Sea of Galilee. This is the first part of John chapter 21. They've been at it all night with nothing to show for it. And Jesus says, throw the net on the right side of the boat. I don't know a lot about fishing, especially first century fishing. I just can't imagine that would have helped. I can't imagine that would have made much of a difference. But lo and behold, fish start jumping into the net. Like they're excited to be there, you know? They just pile into this thing. It's a miracle catch of fish. And so the disciples who haven't cued in just yet, they realize now, oh, it's Jesus. That's the Lord who's told us to do this thing. Now we're connecting the dots and it makes sense. So they haul the catch over to the shoreline. Peter swims. Because why not? That's who he is. Jesus cooks breakfast for everybody. Now, it's not the first time that Jesus, risen Lord, has encountered his followers after the resurrection. But I would guess you don't get used to that sort of thing, hanging out with the man you buried the week prior. So this is a pretty remarkable moment that they're having together on the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee. And you can notice in the scene, Jesus didn't perform a fish-catching miracle just so they'd have something to eat for breakfast. We actually read in John 21 that Jesus is already cooking fish by the fire on the beach when they haul up all these nets full of fish. So why the miracle? What's up with the whole Sea of Galilee charcoal fire catching fish scene? If you're following your notes, the scene is staged by Jesus for Peter's benefit. Jesus is about to tell Peter, follow me. Follow me. And you know where Peter first heard those words? Fishing by the Sea of Galilee. The Gospels report this. Luke, in his Gospel, even tells a story that after a night of fishing with nothing to show for it, Jesus tells Simon Peter to lower the nets into the deep water, and all of a sudden the nets are tearing at the weight of the fish. Jesus is brilliantly creating a moment using one of the most powerful tools in a teacher's toolkit, nostalgia. He's calling Peter back. He's evoking memories from the early days, the good old days, the golden years, simpler times. He's bringing Peter back into this moment. If you're following in your notes, Jesus has taken Peter back to the beginning. When Peter first fell in love with Jesus and said that he would follow him. He's taking him back to that place. But Jesus isn't just there to reminisce. There's another memory that Jesus wants to call to mind. It's a memory, I think, that Peter must have wanted to forget, might have wanted not to mention, might have wanted not to talk about. It was the elephant in the room. And I'm sure it would have already been on Peter's mind each time he encounters Jesus after the resurrection. Jesus is cooking breakfast over a charcoal fire. You know the only other time that a charcoal fire is mentioned in the Gospels? Courtyard of the high priest, when there's Peter saying, I don't know the man, I don't know the man, I don't know the man. So here we are again by a charcoal fire. Jesus is pulling up this memory into view as well. He's calling Peter back to that moment, not only when he first said, yes, I love you, I'll follow you. He's calling him back to that moment when he's swearing up, down, and sideways that he doesn't even know that guy. Both these moments are in view in the recollection that's intended here. Jesus wants to talk about it. I don't know about you, sometimes I like to not talk about my worst moments. Peter would probably rather sweep this under, I mean, don't you hate it when your kid, your parent, your spouse, your friend, your coworker, you know, they're like, hey, you remember when you, and you're like, no, I don't, that doesn't ring a bell. I don't. Water under the bridge, we don't, you know, sweep it under the rug. That's yesterday's news. Let's just move on, you know, ancient history. Let's just pretend it didn't happen. Probably Simon Peter might have felt something like that. That's not how God deals with the ick in our lives, you know. You go back into Genesis and Adam, right? He and Eve, they sin in the Garden of Eden, and what do? Like, oh, let's go hide. Let's go hide from the Lord. That's how they respond when they fail to live up to their calling. But what does God do? God goes looking for them. He chases them down in Eden. So I got to get to these people. We're going to talk about this. We're going to confront and live in reality and deal with sin and betrayal and regret and shame that it produces. So God in Christ goes looking for Peter. Stuffing and stifling isn't going to happen. That's not going to be the strategy that Jesus rolls with, even if we might like to do that at times. If you're following your notes, when we sin, Jesus seeks us out. He goes looking for Peter. So let's pick up the text that we heard read already this morning. John 21, verse 15. When they'd finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, you love me? And he answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? And he said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. There's a lot going on in these verses, but can we at least just recognize the poignant, I mean, this is a powerful moment for these two and for us. There's all kinds of subtext and layering happening here. Some things we need to unpack, so stick with me on this for a minute here. Firstly, Jesus asked Simon Peter, son of John, if he loves Jesus, you love me more than these. More than these. It's not obvious, it's not clear in John's narrative what Jesus means when he says more than these. There's a few options here. It could be that Jesus is saying, do you love me more than you love the other disciples? Like, do you love me more than you love your buddies here, right? Do you love me more than you love the other disciples? And I'll say, for my piece, this seems to me pretty unlikely to be the meaning of the question. Why would Jesus in this moment be pitting love for himself over love for the disciples? In John's gospel, Jesus has explicitly stated that love for Jesus is demonstrated by love for one another. That seems really characteristic of the way that John remembers the story of Jesus. A second option could be, it could be that Jesus is saying, compared to the other disciples and the love they have for me, do you have more love for me than them? Do you love me more than they love me? You hear that question? Now, this is a decent option because Peter did in fact boast in John 13 that he would lay down his life for Jesus. And in Matthew's telling of this same scene, Peter even says, even if all fall away on account of you, not me. I mean, he's pretty explicitly singled himself out as the most faithful disciple. So it very well could be that Jesus is calling him back, maybe calling him out a little bit on the way that he's distinguished himself from others for his supposed fidelity. And then a third option, and we might find this a bit funny at first, but the third option is that Jesus is talking about the fish and the fishing nets, the fishing gear. Do you love me more than these? In other words, this is, you know, more metaphorical. Do you love me more than being a fisherman? The vocation that I would have for you, is it better than what you're doing here overnight this morning, catching fish? And if this is what Jesus means, then he's asking a vocational question, a sort of where do we go from here, Peter? You want to stay and do this and this only? Or do you want something more? So which is it? Which of the three options is Jesus asking when he says, do you love me more than these? Some of you are going to not like me for this. I don't know. I don't know for sure which of these three options Jesus means. In order to say this, sometimes when we interpret the Bible, it's best to remain agnostic on some of these things, not overly committed to our own conjectures and things. And the good news for us here is that in this instance, which interpretation is correct doesn't end up mattering a ton. It's not terribly significant because, in fact, Peter, you may have noticed, doesn't even answer that part of the question, the more than these. What he addresses is just the do you love me. Peter says, you know that I love you. To which Jesus responds, feed my lambs. Feed my lambs. What is that about? It's kind of a strange response. Why all of a sudden are we talking about shepherding here? The word for pastor in Greek in the New Testament is literally shepherd. That's the same word. You're following in your notes in each of his three responses to Peter. Feed my lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my sheep. Jesus is calling Peter to be a pastor. He's calling him to the shepherding vocation. He's commissioning him for his vocation as a caregiver and a leader in the church. Now here's the thing. Peter doesn't deserve that. He doesn't. Jesus just as easily could have said, depart from me. He who denies me before men, I will deny before my Father in heaven. But he doesn't. Jesus told Peter he was going to betray him. Peter does it anyways. And Jesus still calls him back to the fold to be a shepherd for the church. You know, one of the best experiences you can have in life is having somebody love you better than you deserve. And that is the love of God. That is the gospel. That's how Jesus loves Peter. This calling back to shepherding isn't all smooth sailing. From here on out. He's not just saying, well, we had this one little hiccup, but here on out, everything is going to be easy breezy. Let's get back to it. There's an additional subtext to this vocation of shepherding and pastoring. In John chapter 10, Jesus says this, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He lays down his life the sheep. So here's what we can cue into. If Peter is called to be a shepherd, like Jesus is a shepherd. What does that tell us about what will be expected of Peter as he carries out the vocation that Jesus is entrusting to him again? There's a little bit of a hint there. There's a little bit of a foreshadowing there as to what's in store for Peter as he follows Jesus in this renewed vocation that Jesus has given to him. In The Cost of Discipleship, German pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he's later executed by the Nazis, he famously said this: when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. If you're following in your notes, Jesus, he's not just evoking past memories with Peter, he's also foreshadowing Peter's future, giving him a glimpse of the road ahead. Now, there's another detail that's often talked about in this scene, which you can't pick up in English, and that's the words for love that are used in this scene. Some of you will immediately know what I'm talking about. Most of you may not, so let me just catch us up here. In Greek, the language of the New Testament, the language the story is written in, there are multiple words for love. Two of them are used in this passage, agapao and phileo. You can see on screen here, here's a little breakdown of the questions and response. So in Jesus' first question, he asks Peter, do you agapao me? Do you love me? And Peter replies back, I phileo you. And Jesus again, do you agapao me? Peter, I phileo you. And then Jesus switches the question, do you phileo me? And Peter says, I phileo you. So if you're tracking with me to this point, the question simply is this: why doesn't Peter use the same words for love that Jesus uses when he asks the question? And then why does Jesus change the word he uses the final time that he asks? So here's what I'll tell you, and this I say and not the Lord, but there's a pretty strong consensus in scholarship about this. So let me just cue us in. I've seen very well-meaning Christians over the years look at these set of questions and the Greek word changes and think that there's something very significant and yet very subtle happening theologically and spiritually. There's a common myth that agapao, or the noun form agape, which you may have heard of, agape love, that agape always means like divine, perfect love, and phileo is a lesser, a kind of humanly love. Think of Philadelphia, a city of brotherly love. You know, it's different always than divine love. But the fact of the matter is that that's not really the case. In fact, although these words aren't exact synonyms, they can be and very frequently are, especially in John's gospel, used totally interchangeably, back and forth in the same set of in the same context, right? So even though there's some real distinctions, they're not perfect synonyms, these words are often, and I think in this context, are used interchangeably. John has a habit throughout his gospel of varying his word choice merely for the sake of style. He's a good writer, and you sometimes mix up the words that you use so it doesn't sound redundant and repetitive. I think that's my best understanding of what's going on in this scene. Now, if you're a word nerd and you want to like dive deep into that, come talk to me later. I'll show you my footnotes, okay? But I don't want to spend too much time in this tangent. I just want us to understand this. The reason that Peter is hurt is not because Jesus switches up a word choice in the third question. It's because there's a third question. It's because the third time harkens back to the third denial. Three denials, three questions. That's what pangs him in his chest and hits him in his gut. So how is it that Jesus responds when we fail to live up to the love we profess? You can see in this scene, Jesus seeks us out. He seeks us out, he finds us, and he meets our failure with mercy and offers an opportunity for repentance. Not cheap grace. Don't worry about it, Peter. But a calling to a renewed vocation. That's what forgiveness is all about. Forgiveness isn't saying, we'll let it slide. Forgiveness is saying, begin again. That's what Jesus is doing for Peter in this moment. So how do we respond when we fail to live up to the love we profess? There's an interesting parallel in Judas Iscariot. Judas Iscariot and Simon Peter, they both failed the Lord in their own way on that fateful night. Judas was an enemy who pretended to be a friend. And Peter was a friend who pretended to be a bystander. Each of them have let the Lord down. There's a little poem I love by Lucy Shaw. called Judas, Peter. I want you to see this. She says in this poem, "Because we are all betrayers, taking silver and eating body and blood and asking, 'Guilty, is it I?' And hearing him say, 'Yes,' it would be simple for us all to rush out and hang ourselves. But if we find grace to cry and wait, after the voice of mourning has crowed in our ears clearly enough to break our hearts, he will be there to ask us each again, 'Do you love me?'" Jesus responds to us with grace if we will stay with him long enough to receive it and walk in it anew. After Peter is three times restored, three times commissioned in his vocation and love for the Lord, Jesus spells out with greater clarity than ever before what loving him will mean for Peter. John 21, verse 18. "Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." And Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. And then he said to him, "Follow me." About 30 years later, 30 years from the time of the scene on the beach, Peter finds himself in Rome, capital of the empire. Nero is Caesar. And under the reign of Nero in the mid-60s AD, Peter is arrested and crucified. Now, there's a legend in church history that Peter requested to be crucified upside down. We'll probably never know if he actually was or not, but according to the legend, Peter, while hanging upside down on the cross, he gives this long speech. He talks about Adam in Genesis. And essentially what he says is that sin turned the world upside down. And his hanging upside down on the cross is a representation of the human and cosmic condition on account of sin. And Peter kisses the cross, and he clings to it just as he clings to Jesus. Here's why, if you're following your notes. The way of Jesus is the way of the cross. And the cross of Christ is making the world right again. We already live in an upside-down world, and the cross of Christ is turning it upside down all over again. Peter sees that and knows that. When Jesus first said to Peter, "Follow me," he could not have known where that road would lead. He couldn't predict, couldn't have anticipated. Likewise, when you first said yes to Jesus, you had no idea what you were getting yourself into, did you? No, we never do. We never do. We learn along the way that love is cruciform. It is cross-shaped. That's what love is. There's a phrase in church history, ars moriendi. Spiritual formation is ars moriendi. It's the art of dying. That's what it is. That's what following Jesus is about. This is hard. But Jesus calls us each to it in our own small and simple practical ways, day to day throughout our lives. Those of you who may not know me well may not know I'm very introverted. And if I could have my druthers, I would go home every day and just pull into the driveway, hop right out, cross the porch into my house, and watch TV and read a book and like never say a word to anybody who lives outside of my fortress of solitude, okay? That would be ideal for me. But I've been feeling convicted about that lately because Jesus calls me to the way of love. And so some preferences need to get sacrificed for the sake of love. So I've been trying to get to know my neighbors in little small ways, and I'm keeping a little note on my phone. Okay, that's William. He lives down on the corner. He's got grandkids. You know, he loves Disney World, and we talked about soccer that one time, you know. Small, simple, practical ways where I'm trying and learning, and some of you are so much better at this than I am, trying and learning how to live the way of love. So most of us probably don't have a Roman cross at the end of our road, but along the way we have moments of vocation where Jesus says, come and follow me. So that's the invitation. I don't care if you haven't even ever said yes to Jesus before and you wandered in here today and you're like, what is going on? Or maybe you've been following Jesus for 50 years. The invitation is still the same. Come and follow me.
Thank you for listening to this week's teaching. If you'd like more info on our church, you can visit our website or find us on Facebook.